Galileo was the first person to give evidence that we are not the only planet in our solar system. And we are not, in fact, the center of the solar system, nor are we the center of the universe. And through a very revolutionary instrument called the refracting telescope, he was able to glimpse that Jupiter had moons. And these moons orbited not around the Earth, but around Jupiter itself. This was incontrovertible proof that the Earth was not the center of the solar system, which was effectively the universe back then.
I'm Gregory Day. Today we look to the stars on pdxpodcast.com with our special guest, cosmologist, physics professor, and inventor of the Bicep Telescope, Brian Keating. In his book, Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor, Brian gives us an insider's perspective into the highly competitive world of modern science. In 2014, astronomers wielding the Bicep 2 telescope revealed that they glimpsed the spark that ignited the Big Bang. Had they discovered the cosmic prologue, or was it merely a galactic mirage? That's the question at the heart of Brian's manuscript, which is part biography, history lesson, as well as a critique of the Nobel nomination process.
Most people don't have that many opportunities to think about the most ultimate issues of existence and meaning. They usually make a decision early on in life, and then they kind of stick to it. Maybe they're born into a faith, or maybe they're born, you know, to atheist parents or whatever. And, you know, I kind of had this unique upbringing in that I was born to non-practicing Jewish parents, but then I was converted to Catholicism, of all things, and became a kind of priest wannabe at an altar boy in a Catholic church, and then went back to less observancy and even atheism, and how the process really came around for me, sort of full circle, entwined with, you know, becoming a father myself, and going through the challenges that we all face as we get older, our parents get older, but then realizing that sometimes even I wasn't really stopping to look at the big picture. You know, here I am, a cosmologist, a professional astronomer that, you know, literally I get paid to think about the biggest picture, and I was too busy thinking about, well, how do I get liquid helium, you know, to this telescope in time for, you know, to beat this deadline or what have you. And I wasn't taking enough time to really think about the ultimate meaning of what I'm doing and what my colleagues and I are revealing about the universe. And that's where I really felt this privilege to be doing what we're doing. And, you know, thanks to your listeners and taxpayers in this country that we get to be able to do it. And so it is a great privilege. And I think the book is, you know, it's a memoir more than anything of how you can encounter these things and how you can lose your way towards this gilded destination in Stockholm, but along the way realize that the true journey is the prize, not that you win this. Because most of us, let's be honest, Gary, we don't get into our personal promised land, whether that's an Emmy or an Oscar or a Super Bowl title or what have you. In, you know, San Diego, we are the longest city in North America to not have any kind of championship, so we're very acquainted with failure here. But in reality, you know, how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with not winning the Nobel Prize or the Oscar or your high school class presidency for that?
This is Galileo in front of the Holy Office. Holy Office is a euphemism for the Inquisition. Don't you love euphemisms like this? I do. It's like calling the IRS the money donation service. He was imprisoned for the remaining 9 years of his life for thought crimes. And what's amazing, what he was able to do is so amazing and revolutionary. And he did it with a simple instrument, but he used it in a powerful way. And I claim this instrument changed our understanding of the universe more than any other scientific instrument. This is the Earth at night looking out on the stars, which we now know are but pinpricks of light to our eyes, the two refracting telescopes in our heads. With our eyes, we can look out in space and look out in time, and we can glimpse these distant objects. We now know that these objects represent suns that harbor planets and moons. And these suns are just one of hundreds of billions in our galaxy alone. And guess what? There are hundreds of billions of galaxies as well in the universe. Galileo unseated us as the center of it all. And with the telescope, magnified, if you will, to mix metaphors, our insignificance. So tonight, what will be interesting to discover along with me is what you would see if you had microwave eyes. If you had microwave eyes, instead of seeing pinpricks of light from stars, you'd see this magnificent tapestry that represents the pattern of photons coming to us from the Big Bang itself, 13.8 billion years ago. It's an amazing image that captures the properties of matter, energy, dark energy, throughout our entire cosmic history. With our eyes and our brains, we can attempt to make an image of the infant universe. To what can this be compared? I like to think of what would be the earliest possible baby photograph that you could possibly take. That would be to image this object over here. So I'm a doctor. I'm not a real doctor, according to my brothers. But I still prescribe medicine. No, I don't do that. This is called a blastocyst. It's a collection of cells, about 200 to 400 cells, that represent the human embryo roughly 1,000 seconds after conception. 1,000 seconds after your own personal Big Bang. This blastocyst is an amazingly complicated structure. What we're trying to do with our instrument at the South Pole is uncover what the universe looked like a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, the so-called inflationary universe, the spark that ignited the Big Bang.
It's important for your listeners to understand, as I point out in the book, that we didn't fail with BICEP. We didn't make a blunder and kind of leave the lens cap on the camera, as I often do when I'm trying to catch a picture of my kids. But we made a measurement, but what we did is our interpretation was sort of a rushed into the judgment of what it actually, you know, it was actually incorrectly
right.
interpreted.
Right.
And how that was driven by these desires and kind of, as I said before, confirmation bias, et cetera, how that could actually portray the reality of what science is about sometimes. But I think it's important to realize that the quest continues. It's not like we, you know, we went away. I mean, there have been many blunders in scientific history, far worse than ours. It's just that I happened to witness mine and then get nominated for the Nobel Prize and get invited to nominate the next year's winner. So I think it's sort of a unique perspective. As you said before, I don't think anyone's ever written a book like this.
No, they
haven't.
You know,
most of the books are written on, you know, they're actually done.
Right. Well, most people don't question Nobel at all.
Right. Yes. And it really is this emperor, which, you know, may or may not be naked. And I thought it was important to examine. It's really society's most sacred cow.
Yes, it
and
is.
And while we are comfortable deconstructing, you know, some people say, well, you just have sour grapes and you're a sore loser. But, you know, as you know from reading the book, that a lot of the book is really advocating that women and minorities and others should be receive the compensation that they were denied unfairly and unjustly. And
yes.
I'm not a woman or a minority, and I think, you know, it's as if saying, you know, you can't criticize the president of the United States if you haven't been president. So I think it's a little shallow when people say that, but I expect it. And I just want people to know that the really the heart of the book is this passionate quest and ambition to understand how the universe evolved. And we should do so with agnosticism towards this gilded medallion, which is really, you know, I mean, your listeners may not know this because it's so opaque. It may keep it opaque for 50 years. No one will know that I nominated, unless they read the book. They won't know that
right.
I was one of the nominators of the Nobel Prize. And why is that? Why does it need to be kept secret for 50 years?
For 50 years,
right? Yeah, it's longer than
it just
me,
seems
you know,
so arbitrary that all, I mean, so many rules just seem so arbitrary. It seems to be very bureaucratic.
You run a monopoly. Your greatest priority is to maintain your monopoly and not allow anyone to break into the marketplace.
Right.
And so for the Nobel Prize, it's society's greatest monopoly on accolades and awards. So I don't think there's anything nearly as prestigious as it is. And so I think it has a special obligation to humanity, to the planet, to maintain its integrity. And to do so would mean it has to be more transparent. It has to change its rules and regulations, and has to do so in a way that's just and fair to Alfred Nobel's vision and to the way that science and society is done nowadays, not in 1895 when the will was written down.
Inflation takes place in a vast landscape potentially called the multiverse, in which multiple universes could exist. We're trying to take this image of the night sky in microwaves and transform from it an image of what the baby universe must have looked like. My colleagues at NASA have done a wonderful job of rendering this image as if you were an omniscient deity looking down on our universe and seeing it from a distance. This is the pattern that you'd see on this beach ball. This image inspired me to unravel what caused these colorful fluctuations. What could break the symmetry, the isotropy of the early universe, filled with chaos and randomness? What could possibly be the origin of those fluctuations is what has driven me in my career. In 2001, I pitched an idea to my advisor at Caltech, Professor Andrew Lang, who believed in me, thank God, because it was a crazy and risky thing to do as a young postdoc toiling away. He said, "Brian, this might be the ultimate cosmic wild goose chase, but we should do it." And we did do it. We assembled an amazing team of about 24 scientists from around the world, led by Professor John Kovac at Harvard University. And with this amazing team, we were able to construct a beautiful instrument that's compact yet powerful. Doesn't quite fit in your pocket. It's about 5 feet long, weighs about 10,000 pounds, but Galileo would recognize it. If your pocket holds an iPhone 6, maybe it does.
I'd like to close by talking about Andrew Lang, father figure for you. You know, this book is part of sort of dedicated to him in a way.
Yeah. So Andrew Lang was, you know, for those that don't know, he was a National Academy member, a professor of physics at, you know, at Caltech, you know, arguably one of the best institutions in the world for cosmology. He had made measurements that, you know, put him onto the short list of Nobel laureates for years. But for years he didn't win it, and despite that he was a tremendous scientist and seeker of truths. And I think for me he also took on this added responsibility, and I don't know why. And I think we just have this relationship that really resonated. That he treated me, and he used to you know, say that he was like a father to me, and I agreed to him with him that he was. And tragically, just a few weeks after we, you know, through his hard work and the backing that he provided to me and to others at Caltech, where I was a postdoc before I became a professor at UC San Diego, he took his own life right after we deployed this experiment. And it really put so much into focus for me as to, you know, what a tremendous blow this was, that what we were doing was so minuscule in comparison. You know,
there are
theories that there are multiple universes and that we'll see each other again. But I just bemoan the fact that this great man had everything going for him, everything that you could possibly want in life, and is no longer here to see the great panorama that his wisdom and intelligence allowed to unfold for me and for hundreds of other young scientists. So, yes, in a very real way, this book would just not be possible without him. And I dedicate a large portion of it to his memory, in the hopes that, you know, his sons will find some solace in the impact that he had, at least on me, and I know on hundreds of others too. I'm glad you touched on Andrew Lang, because part of it is I want scientists to never do that, and I want them to know that there's help, there's resources, there's people that will be impacted so dramatically that they shouldn't contemplate it. And, you know, I still get welled up when I think about him. So I want the book to have an impact, but the point is I want it to impact young scientists. You know, I had one young lady tell me that, you know, she dropped out of school as an astronomy major because her father said, "Well, you'll never win a Nobel Prize, so you're not going to be a great scientist." And she said, "I wish I had your book 10 years ago. It would have changed my life." And that's why I wrote the book. And I hope that others will react similarly to it.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Brian. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Great talking to you, Greg. And it was a real thrill and an honor for me to talk with you and your listeners. So have a great day.
Thanks so much.
I think Galileo himself, the maestro, would be very pleased that our discoveries made with a simple refracting telescope have changed our view of the universe yet again. Let us thank the maestro by giving him a bigger bicep. Thank you very much.
Today's show was produced and edited by Gregory Day, that's me. You heard excerpts from Brian's talk at TEDx San Diego, going to the ends of the earth to discover the beginning of time. If you'd like to reach me directly, you can reach me at greg@pdxpodcast.com. We'll be back next Monday. See you then.
The title suggests that it's mostly about the Nobel Prize. It's really not. It's just really a history of cosmology is told through the lens of humanity's inherent peccadilloes and failings, which is that we often overestimate our importance and overlook the most humbling of substances.
Right.
In our case, dust. And then how do you deal with failure? You know, I say to people, it's a how-to book in a certain sense. I don't want your listeners to lose the Nobel Prize if they have a chance to win it. But on the other hand, it has aspects of how to cope with adversity and failure, embarrassment,
yes,
humiliation,
yes,
that we felt. And those were all real emotions. And
right,
scientists are human beings, despite the stereotypes.
And I really appreciated about that book, you examined the scientific process, your process, and perhaps ways to reevaluate how science operates, and I mean the entire infrastructure of how nobles are awarded. You suggested at the end of the book to present the award to teams, to groups, and I think that does keep in with the spirit of Nobel.
Yes, exactly. And you see nowadays, I didn't plan on this, but you see all these controversies that are plaguing the Nobel Prizes, from the prospects of Donald Trump winning a Nobel Peace Prize, which I'm sure would shock many of your listeners, to the Nobel Prize in Literature being rocked by a sex abuse scandal that claimed not the man who committed the alleged crimes against women, but instead the woman who was the head of the Swedish Royal Academy of Literature. So she lost the job. She's basically the president of the entity that awards the Nobel Prizes in Literature. And finally, the King of Sweden had enough of it and decided that he was going to force the Nobel committees to cancel the Nobel Prizes in Literature. So all these things are rocking the Nobel Prizes right now, and there's high time for reform and reflection. So just as they're putting a pause on the Nobel Prize in Literature, I propose reformation of the Nobel Prize in the sciences, so that it can really live up to the Nobel LE, you know, visions that Alfred had 122 years ago. And it shouldn't really surprise people that the prizes are terribly outdated. You know, it was written down in a time when they were still bloodletting and leeches in medicine and phrenology. And so why wouldn't these prizes need an update from the lone white male geniuses who used to be the paradigm of how science was done?
And you touch on that with, I think, Via Rubin, her discovery of dark matter. Vera Rubin,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Vera Rubin, that's
right.
Exactly right, Jocelyn. Well, and all these women that discovered these Nobel-worthy phenomena that were done accidentally. And it's funny because, you know, when men discover things accidentally, as the discovery of the cosmic microwave background
serendipitously.
Yeah, completely serendipitously. Of course, they were men. And they won the Nobel Prize in 1978.
Right.
In 2011, the scientist who discovered dark energy won the Nobel Prize and for its serendipitous discovery of the acceleration of the universe. And now Vera Rubin is deceased as of Christmas Day 2016. So by the other rules that the Nobel Prize has chosen to institute long after Alfred Nobel's will,
right,
she is forever ineligible. And I think that's, you know, we demand that there's, you know, justice prevail would mean that she should receive it. But, you know, the story is also, I think, one of the interpersonal dynamics of scientists. You know, people, your listeners may think of scientists as stereotypically kind of devoid of emotion and passion and squabbles and above pettiness. But there's a lot of that in science, and there's a lot of beauty in science. But I want to portray the humanity of it as well.
Right, the poetry of science.